And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. This is your apocalyptically genial host, John Derbyshire, with some shards of the week's news. I apologise for traffic noise in the background. I'm on the road and recording from a friend's apartment in New York City. More on that later. There hasn't actually been much eye-stopping news this week, so I'm going to exercise pundit's privilege and pass comment on some large general social and political trends, on the slow currents of the deep ocean, rather than the storms and navigational hazards of the surface. Identifying and prognosticating about broad historical trends is a bit of a mug's game. Surveying the science fiction of 50 or 100 years ago, what people of those times thought their future, which is our present, would be like, shows how very limited our abilities are in this area. If there's not much hope of definitive answers, though, I believe there's some value in asking the questions. So, let's ask them. Question. How will the mass invasions of Europe, or European-founded nations, by the wretched refuse of the Third World's teeming shores, work out? These great movements of people are, in my opinion, the biggest social and historical phenomenon of our age. Again, they're not precisely news, as they go on relentlessly month after month, year after year, like the weather. There is, in fact, a school of immigration romantics, Tamar Jacoby is representative, who argue that mass third world immigration is like the weather, beyond the power of human beings to control. It's bound to happen. Just get used to it. Nothing we can do about it. Particular news items do emerge, of course. To pluck a couple at random from this week's headlines. Headline from Breitbart.com, October 30th. Department of Homeland Security reports 179,027 convicted criminal aliens with deportation orders remain in the US. The DHS was responding to questions from the Senate Subcommittee on Immigration and the National Interest. In their responses, they revealed that over 900,000, that's close to a million, illegal aliens who have been ordered deported remain in the US in defiance of the order. Of that 900,000, in 20% of cases, that's the 179,000 in the headline, the order of deportation was issued because the illegal alien had been arrested and charged with a crime. Just pause for a moment, gentle listener, to reflect on the following two phrases. One, Department of Homeland Security. Two, Sanctuary City. Headline from the New York Times, October 31st. German government tells village of 102 it will get 750 refugees. This is the village of Sunte in Lower Saxony, up in north-central Germany, described by the Times as, quote, a bucolic one-street settlement of handsome red-brick farmhouses, which may have many more cows than people, end quote. Further quote from the Times, quote, Sunte has no shops, no police station, no school. The initial number of arrivals was in fact reduced to avoid straining the local sewage system and to give time for new pumps to be installed, end quote. Originally, you see, Sunte, population 102, remember, originally it was scheduled to get 1,000 of the illegals. the 750 they're now going to get is a reduced number. And the Times' description of the incomers as refugees is, of course, bogus. Even the unknown number of them who were actually fleeing danger ceased to be refugees once they left Turkey, where they were safely housed in refugee camps. Having migrated from Turkey into Europe without papers, they are illegal aliens. So, yes, there are particular news items emerging from these mass migrations. But the migrations themselves have been going on for years and look set fair to go on for years more. That's what I mean by a historical phenomenon, as opposed to a transient news story. So again, with the question, how will these mass migrations play out? Of course, I don't know, and neither does anyone else. I can, though, make a list of things that might happen and assign probabilities. Here are five scenarios. There may be others that haven't occurred to me. Scenario one, absorption. All will be well. The migrants, in whatever numbers choose to come, will enrich and energize our tired, aging societies. They will take on our liberal values and become good Europeans, Americans, and Canadians. Scenario two, restriction. Political pressure from their native populations will force receiving nations to stem the flow. Fences will go up, coastal patrols will commence, but those illegals who are in will be allowed to stay in. Scenario three, rejection. There will be a real uprising of native peoples. Illegals will be deported en masse to their countries of origin. Scenario four, surrender. The native European and European descended populations, innervated by soft living and psychologically disarmed by globalist propaganda, will yield up their societies to the invaders. Scenario five, fragmentation. Some part or parts of the First World will opt for one of the foregoing scenarios, some other part or parts for a different one. Got that? One, absorption. Two, restriction. Three, rejection. Four, surrender. Five, fragmentation. Allow me separate segments to mull over these scenarios and try to assign some probabilities. Okay, my five scenarios once again. One, absorption. Two, restriction. Three, rejection. Four, surrender. Five, fragmentation. I'll take them in turn. Absorption, the migrants in any quantity happily melting in to the host populations, is the actual stated position of many powerful groups. Libertarian economists, for example, under their standard bearer, The Economist magazine, take this cheerful position. Let them come. The more the better. We need the workers. They'll pay for our entitlements. Most Western politicians, Angela Merkel most obviously, Barack Obama, David Cameron, the new Prime Minister of Canada, most of them support this line, to judge from their speeches and actions. Or, in the case of Cameron, lack of actions. Yes, they're all on board with scenario one. Let them come. We'll absorb them. There are two problems with scenario one, though. One mathematical and one scientific. First problem, it's innumerate. Second problem, it ignores HBD, human biodiversity. I'll deal with HBD another time. I only have one pair of hands. Let me just have a little fun with numbers here. Think back to that German village of 102 souls having 750 illegals dumped on them. That's a ratio, dumped to dumped on, a ratio of 7.4 to 1. Now, add up the major first world population numbers. The EU, the USA, Canada, Australia, and Japan. You get a pretty neat 1 billion there. So, if 7.4 billion people were to move to the first world, we'd be in just the same position demographically as that German village. Is that going to happen? Not right now, it's not. The entire non-first world population of the world is only 6 billion, and most of those would probably prefer to stay home. Still, 6 billion is 6 billion. If only 1 in 6 of them wanted to move to the first world, and we let them, we just doubled our population. If it turned out to be 1 in 3, we tripled it. Things would actually be a tad worse than that if Japan were to continue its current policy of essentially zero immigration. Then Europe, America, and Canada would get Japan's share. And that's on today's numbers. The latest UN projections are for a world population of 11.2 billion people at century's end, in spite of, quote, declines in Europe and East Asia. First world populations could be outnumbered 10 to 1 when our grandkids retire. 7.4 to 1, that's the Sumti ratio, for foreigners settled in the first world, isn't so far out of reach. For comparison here, the USA considers itself immigrant-friendly, yet the highest ever proportion of foreign-born in our population was in 1890, at just under 15%. When those 750 illegals have been settled in Sumte, that little German village will have 88% of its inhabitants foreign-born. 15%? 88%. Under scenario 1, the future demography of the first world will be somewhere between those 2%. Somewhere between 1890 USA and 2015 Sumte. Most likely towards the Sumte end of the scale. That's not wild speculation. It's what our leaders want. It's what The Economist argues for every damn week. I'm a subscriber. I read their stuff. It's what we're allowing to happen. The globalists believe foreign populations are infinitely absorbable. Didn't we absorb that 15% from 1890? Yes, we did. 15% in a big, empty country that needed lots of unskilled labour. 15%, nearly all white Europeans, when other races were excluded. 15% and absorption much assisted by a 44-year moratorium on further immigration, 1921 to 1965. 30%? 40%? Of different races and religions, pouring in relentlessly, no moratorium in sight? Absorption will not happen. My estimate of the probability for scenario 1 coming to pass? 0. The globalists are dreaming. And their dream is our nightmare. Right now, today, it's Sumte's nightmare. Let's continue working our way through these scenarios. Scenario 2. Restriction. The first world comes to its senses and stanches the flood, reducing it to a trickle and accepting the presence of most of the illegals via some kind of amnesty. Here we are actually in the realm of possibility. It sounds like a moderate solution. It has that split the difference quality to it that legislatures in democratic countries like. It's not too politically incorrect. Hey, we've accepted all these foreigners. We'll make them into good Americans, Europeans, Canadians. And look, we've built a high fence around the country to control the flow. Definitely possible. I would accord this a high probability, 50 or 60%. However, it's chastening to think of how far we currently are from even this moderate position. Sure, it has been the stated policy of some American politicians. Those politicians are characterized by the American media as right-wing, though. And even when elected, they do nothing to follow through on their talk. In Europe, they don't even get elected. The standard bearer for restriction in Britain, the UKIP party, UKIP, has just one seat in Parliament. The USA still has no complete border fence. The EU has bits of one, thanks to local initiatives by politicians like Hungary's Viktor Orban. Initiatives much criticised as extreme by media and political elites. And while scenario 2 might very well happen, it's not actually a very good result. The first world would end up with big subpopulations of blacks and Muslims, two groups that no European nation anywhere has been able fully to assimilate. If we're politically a long way from scenario 2, then scenario 3, that's rejection, is out of sight below the horizon. In scenario 3, the first world would not only close its borders, it would expel illegal aliens. There are big first world constituencies in support of this. Donald Trump has championed it in the USA, and he's polling well. Even more extreme measures have sizable constituencies. A year ago in Britain, the Daily Telegraph reported that, quote, a survey conducted for British Future, that's some kind of think tank, found 25% of people agreed that the government should, quote, insist that all immigrants should return to the countries they came from, whether they're here legally or illegally, end quote, end quote. Again, a quarter of Brits want all immigrants, legal and illegal, expelled. How much they want it is open to question, given the poor performance of UKIP in this year's election over there. But at least they're open to the idea. Given the aforementioned difficulties of getting just to the milder scenario 2, though, scenario 3 seems to me way out of sight. A nuclear-scale terrorist attack or some really serious civil disturbances might change this. But as things stand, I think 5% is a generous estimate of the probability for scenario 3. So, scenario 2, restriction, I'm rating at probability 50 to 60%. Scenario 3, rejection, at 5% maximum. Scenario 1, forget about it. Notwithstanding, it's the darling position of all first world elites. That leaves us with scenarios 4 and 5, surrender or fragmentation. Scenario 4, surrender, is the one envisioned in Camp of the Saints, Jean Raspail's 1973 novel about a third world invasion of Europe. Their will sapped by ethno-masochism and decades of prosperity, the Europeans lie back and let it happen. I would by no means rule that out. After years of asking the rhetorical question, what the hell is wrong with white people? I have become persuaded by those who argue, as Kevin MacDonald did at the National Policy Institute's conference in Washington, D.C. the other day, that there is some widespread psychopathology among whites. An empathic disorder, MacDonald calls it. Also, pathological altruism, in which inclinations to benevolence and empathy turn self-destructive. So yes, the white race may be committing slow suicide, from the best possible intentions. It can't be ruled out. Stranger things have happened. Read my account of the attempted national suicide of the Xhosa people in the 1850s, published in vdare.com last July. And think of the way Mexicans and Central Americans have occupied our southwestern states. New Mexico is close to half Latino now. California and Texas are 40%. Most of that's happened quite recently, in a single generation. And anyone who's objected was shouted down as bigoted, nativist, and un-American. So for scenario 4, surrender and civilizational suicide, I would assign a 10% probability. That's my way of saying I'd be surprised if it happens, but not very surprised. Here's where you get into a shouting match with white nationalists, though. No, they insist, whites will only tolerate so much of this marginalization. Then they'll rise up and take back the situation. What do I think of that? I think it might happen in some places. This is scenario 5, fragmentation. If it were to happen everywhere, then we'd be back in scenario 3, rejection. Rejection won't likely happen everywhere, though. That's why I assigned it only 5% probability. In both America and Europe, there are regions where ethno-masochism is deeply entrenched as a local religion. In Europe, Sweden seems to be the worst case. In America, New England and its cultural offshoot in the Midwest, which latter also has lots of Scandinavians. There are, however, other regions where real resistance could happen. In America, the Southeast and portions of the Mountain West might resist being swamped. In Europe, the main fault line is the old Iron Curtain. Those parts of the EU that were once satellites of the USSR, Poland, the Baltic states, the eastern part of Germany, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Slovenia, Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria, those are the parts least hospitable to the illegal aliens. The last three of those, Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria, are outside the so-called Schengen area of unrestricted travel across national borders, so they have more national freedom of action. The others, within the Schengen area, are supposed to knuckle under to Mutti Merkel's plan to send them hundreds of thousands of obstreperous black and Muslim youths, along with a few women and children as human shields. They're not knuckling. Headline from the Washington Post, September 28th. A small town in Slovakia held a vote on accepting refugees. 97% said no. The headline is really all you need there. Europe really could break apart over this. Could America? And if so, would it be by secession or expulsion? Because some part wanted to go, or because the rest of us wanted them gone? Either, I'd say, is conceivable at a small but non-zero probability. Idaho could secede. California could be expelled. No, I don't really expect either thing, but either is possible. It's Europe where the real possibility for fragmentation exists. With that in mind, for the First World as a whole, I would rate the probability of some fragmentation somewhere, that's scenario 5, quite high. Note that this includes the case where different scenarios work out in Europe and America. That's the argument Mark Stein makes in America Alone, that Europe will surrender, but the USA will resist. I don't buy Mark's thesis, but if it happens, I'll count it as fragmentation. Since something must happen, my 5 scenarios need to have probabilities adding up to 100%. So far I have 0, 50 to 60, 5 and 10. That leaves a probability of 25 to 35% for scenario 5, which I think is reasonable. And the winner is restriction. Fences, coastal patrols, bribes to foreign states to keep their people home, or like Turkey, to maintain refugee camps, and amnesty. That's what I'd put my money on. Just a couple of footnotes to the foregoing segments. First footnote. I started off there with a reference to, quote, the wretched refuse of the Third World's teeming shores. That was, of course, an allusion to Emma Lazarus's poem, The New Colossus, which you can find in its entirety inscribed on a brass plaque in the museum attached to the Statue of Liberty, even though the Statue of Liberty did not originally have anything to do with immigration. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, wrote Ms. Lazarus in 1883. Her lines are endlessly quoted by immigration romantics, some of whom seem to think they were endorsed by the founding fathers. No reference to the new Colossus should be left standing alone without some counter-reference to Thomas Bailey Aldrich's poem, Wide and Unguarded Stand Our Gates, written a dozen years later. It's too long to quote in full, but here's the closing stanza, quote, O Liberty, white goddess, is it well to leave the gates unguarded? On thy breast fold sorrow's children, soothe the hurts of fate, lift the downtrodden, but with hand of steel stay those who to thy sacred portals come to waste the gifts of freedom. Have a care, lest from thy brow the clustered stars be torn and trampled in the dust, for so of old the thronging Goth and Vandal trampled Rome, and where the temples of the Caesars stood, the lean wolf unmolested made her lair. Second footnote. I'm reading a new book by Michelle Malkin and John Miano. Full title, Sold Out, How High-Tech Billionaires and Bipartisan Beltway Crap Weasels are Screwing America's Best and Brightest Workers. That's the title. The book is a spirited expose of the H-1B and other guest worker rackets. Official publication date is November 10th, but you can pre-order from Amazon, and I urge you to do so. It's an excellent companion volume to Ann Coulter's Adios America, which I've been doing my best to promote. I'll be reviewing Sold Out at vidare.com next week. Possibly relevant to my remarks on Scenario 4, that was Surrender, possibly relevant is this much-noted study on rising mortality rates among middle-aged white proles in America. Middle-aged here means ages 45 to 54. Proles means people with no college education. The study is by two Princeton economists, husband and wife. The husband, a Nobel Prize winner. It's been written up all over, but I'm working from the New York Times November 2nd report. Money quote. The analysis by Dr. Deaton and Dr. Case may offer the most rigorous evidence to date of both the causes and implications of a development that has been puzzling demographers in recent years. The declining health and fortunes of poorly educated American whites. In middle age, they are dying at such a high rate that they are increasing the death rate for the entire group of middle-aged white Americans, Dr. Deaton and Dr. Case found. The mortality rate for whites 45 to 54 years old with no more than a high school education increased by 134 deaths per 100,000 people from 1999 to 2014. End quote. That's a 22% rise across a decade and a half. Death rates for every other group you can identify, including middle-aged blacks and Hispanics, are declining. What's more, the rates for middle-aged prole whites in France, Germany, Britain, Sweden, Australia, and Canada are also declining. This seems to be just an American phenomenon. What the heck is going on here? It's really an astonishing finding. Only in this one group, non-college-educated, middle-aged white Americans, only in this group do we see this sharp increase in death rates. Why? The researchers, combing through the causes of death, deduced that, quote, taken together, suicides, drugs, and alcohol explained the overall increase in deaths, end quote. Okay, but then what explains the suicide, drugs, and alcohol? The researchers note big recent increases among the affected group in reported chronic pain, neck pain, face pain, joint pain, sciatica, and corresponding increases in prescription narcotics. But what's causing all that? A commenter at the New York Times website gets a good piece of the answer, I believe. Quote, I'm suspicious of this pain-drug argument. Such widespread reports of pain are a symptom of something else, of despair. Everything in life that was once important to these middle-aged whites has been lost to them. Their jobs, family, community, social status, self-esteem, even their values have become obsolete. In a real sense, they have been discarded by society. They have lost their very identities as human beings. That's what's killing them, not the drugs. End quote. I agree. These are the casualties of the Cold Civil War. Middle-aged white proles are mostly bad whites, with an outlook, opinions, and habits scorned and despised by the good white elites who own the commanding heights of our culture, and whose death rates, the Times tells us, are declining, along with all other death rates, except for this one group. Nobody stands up for middle-aged white proles. The Democratic Party, which used to, is now owned by Goldman Sachs, the anti-white race lobbies, and the man-hating, marriage-hating feminists. The Republican Party is a front for billionaire donors and the Chambers of Commerce. These middle-aged bad whites have no representation and no prospects. Attitudes towards them from the rest of society range from indifference to hot hatred. They have no social refuges. The factory bowling leagues and Elks clubs are long gone. Robert Putnam has documented all that. Nobody's going to pay them a decent working wage, not when there's cheap foreign labour in abundance via liberal immigration policies. Even assuming all that, though, why is it just American white proles who are dying? Here's another New York Times headline, this one from October 31st. Headline: Lights out in Britain for the coal industry. Substance of the story: in December, Kellingley Colliery in Yorkshire, Britain's last deep coal mine, is scheduled to close for good. That got my eye because I come from a family of coal miners. When I was a kid, it seemed like every other working male in England was a coal miner. It was in fact around 3% and already declining. But in the little pit villages where my relatives lived, every other was about right. The marginalisation of middle-aged white proles is universal in the First World. So, why is it only in America that researchers found this trend? Well, for historical, cultural, and racial reasons, the Cold Civil War is fought here with more pitiless ferocity than elsewhere. Scorn for and loathing of bad whites, especially bad white males, is much stronger here than in other countries. Then there are differences in availability of drugs and guns, which have to affect the suicide and accidental death rates. And then, I wish I could find the breakdown here by sex. I suspect, as does a high proportion of commenters on this story, I suspect that this phenomenon is mainly driven by males. With that in mind, going back to the despair issue, there's divorce, which it seems to me is more painful and destructive here for men than is the case elsewhere. If I remember my scripture correctly, to him that hath, more shall be given. But from him that hath not, the divorce lawyers will take away even the little that he hath. If I'm right about males driving this, then there is something deep and cultural here. You know how different nations have stereotypes of each other. Germans are methodical. Italians are excitable. Scandinavians are dour. The Chinese love gambling, and so on and so on. Well, one stereotype of Americans that I grew up with in England, and it goes back all the way to colonial times, was that American men are terrified of their women. Having now, in my circle of acquaintance, several middle-aged men who have been through divorces, my general respect for stereotypes has only grown. What's to be done? Well, we could round up all the bad whites and put them on a reservation somewhere. Their collective situation, after all, is very much like that of an Indian tribe, once bold with warrior spirit and purposeful in defense of its hunting grounds and its customs. Then subdued by conquest, and given easy liquor and opiates to dull their pain. Please don't think I'm being callous or flippant. These are my people. My parents, my uncles and aunts, my grandparents were all white proles, industrial or low-class clerical workers. Here's another quote from that Times story about the end of deep coal mining in England. They are interviewing a 50-year-old miner, a guy right in the middle of the age range that we're talking about. Quote from him. "I will be putting the lights out," he said, adding that after a quarter century in the industry, he would particularly miss not just his paycheck, but the unique camaraderie among colleagues who work together underground. End quote. Let's face it, middle-aged bad whites are surplus to requirements. The economy doesn't need them, the women and the men don't need each other, and all the signals they get from their social superiors, from TV and the movies, from the churches and universities, from law and politics, all the signals are of loathing and contempt. Hey, you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, pal. White privilege. And you blew it. Loser. They shoot horses, don't they? Just in case you're not yet sufficiently depressed, here's another headline. This one from Reuters, November 3rd. Headline: Americans becoming less religious, especially young adults, says poll. Sample quotes. The share of US adults who say they believe in God, while still high compared with other advanced industrial countries, slipped to 89% in 2014 from 92% in 2007. According to the Pew Research Center's Religious Landscape Study. The trend is most pronounced among young adults, with only half of those born from 1990 to 1996 absolutely certain of their belief in God, compared to 71% of the silent generation. That's people born from 1928 to 1945. Younger people are also less likely to pray daily, at 39%, compared to silent generation adults at 67%. Young adults are also much less likely to attend religious services, the survey found. End quotes. None of this will be news to readers of my world-shattering bestseller, We Are Doomed, which predicted it all in the religion chapter, chapter 8. Now, as then, I don't view religious decline with any satisfaction, in spite of being irreligious myself. A healthy society ought to be able to tolerate a few free-thinking freaks and sports like me, but widespread shared religious belief is an essential social binding force, and without it, things fall apart. And also, as has been said, although I don't think we've pinned down who said it, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. Most people have a religious module wired into their brains. As with musicality or athleticism, the inclination is stronger in some than in others, but it comes as a standard feature. If traditional religion won't occupy it, something else will. My own religious module being feeble and underdeveloped, I'm very much aware of religiosity in others. Just as, if your music module is dry and shrunken, it's all the more astounding to watch Lang Lang play the piano. Well, I see that religious module at work in ideologues. Political correctness is just the puritanism of our time. The passion for diversity is the universal love preached by all religious teachers. Those are not, of course, original observations, but I do believe that we irreligious types are more acutely aware of them than others. Placing one's hopes for perfection and harmony in another world is, I am sure, much more socially healthful than seeking to perfect this world. This world can be improved, but it can't be perfected. Unhooked from the supernatural, the religious impulse does nothing but harm. So, this decline in traditional religious belief is, according to me, bad news. Unfortunately, it's inevitable, as I explained in We Are Doomed. And so, we are doomed. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. A Republican presidential candidates update. Not much going on. Quinnipiac released a poll on Wednesday showing Trump and Carson in a statistical tie among Republicans. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz 10 points behind them. And Jeb Bush in low single digits, getting lower. Trump's appeal remains as the anti-system candidate. A lot of people really hate the system. An acquaintance explained his support of Trump thus, quote, "The best thing that could happen to the USA right now would be a massive thermonuclear explosion over Washington, D.C. while Congress and the Supreme Court are in session. Failing that, Donald Trump is second best." End quote. I think this sentiment is quite widely shared. Carson is obviously a very nice man, and I assume that he scoops the evangelical Christian vote. His other big advantage is that he fulfills the deep, ancient yearning among American whites for a gentlemanly black guy. The keynote here was struck by movie actor John Wayne speaking of black lounge singer Nat King Cole. Quote from the Duke, "If only more of them were like that." Rubio, who favours open borders, and Cruz, who is stern on illegal aliens but who wants a flood of legal guest workers to displace American workers, Rubio and Cruz are vying for the billionaire vote. Jeb Bush is retreating towards his supply lines, which are thinning out as donors desert him for Rubio and Cruz. And it's 1 year now to the general. Item. One more note on those candidates. Donald Trump is to be the host of Saturday Night Live this weekend. This isn't very surprising. Not as surprising to me as the fact that Saturday Night Live is still on the air 30 years after it stopped being funny. Obviously, NBC is looking for a ratings bump. Latinos who hate Trump because he wants to enforce federal laws, Latinos are protesting about the hosting gig. One Latino group, calling itself Deport Racism, which is an anagram of I Scared Trump. Not quite Trump, but Trump. I Scared Trump. Coincidence? I think not. Well, this group, Deport Racism, has offered a bounty of $5,000 to anyone on the show set or in the studio audience who will disrupt the live TV broadcast by shouting out the words, "Deport Racism," or "Trump is a racist." They give you $5,000 if you do that. The best comeback to this was a comment on the website of The Hill magazine. Quote, "Trump should open the show with, 'Everybody, on a count of three, call me a racist. One, two, three. Now, this group owes each of you $5,000. Here is the address and phone number where you can send them the bill, and I will provide legal services to help you collect." End quote. The Latinos didn't really think this through, did they? But there, it's a low mean IQ population, so perhaps we shouldn't expect too much. Item. This one's from the London Daily Telegraph, November 1st. Headline: Meet the world's first android actress. This robot actress, name of Geminoid F, made an appearance on the red carpet at this year's Tokyo International Film Festival, although in a wheelchair, as they haven't yet figured out how to make her walk. The movie she's in is a Japanese sci-fi drama, Sayonara, about two friends in the aftermath of a nuclear disaster. That's according to the Telegraph story. The movie database, IMDb, on the other hand, describes the plot thus, quote, "A US Air Force major in Kobe confronts his own opposition to marriages between American servicemen and Japanese women when he falls for a beautiful performer," end quote. So, depending which reference source you believe, the movie is a remake of either The Day After or From Here to Eternity. You'll have to go see it to find out. Let me know. It seems to me that Geminoid F is, strictly speaking, not an android, but a gynoid. Oh, unless, of course, she, he, or it is a transoid, or whatever the Greek root is there. Don't ask me. Item, speaking of trans, here's a thing to take note of, just in case you doubted that our culture has gone sheer gibbering, squealing, bat poop crazy. Imagine you have a teenage daughter. Perhaps you have, so just think about her. She's at school. She just finished a gymnastics event. She's in the girls' locker room taking a shower. Through the steam, she is suddenly aware of another person in the shower with her. It's a large, muscular, hairy, naked, 17-year-old guy with a full set of tackle. She screams. The guy reacts gruffly. "What's the problem?" "What are you doing here?" she gasps, trying to cover her essentials. "This is the girls' locker room." "Right," he growls. "And I identify as a girl. You got a problem with that?" If your daughter does have a problem with it, she is shamefully transphobic. If the school has a problem with it, the federal government will come down on them like a ton of bricks. Or like a 17-year-old guy who identifies as female, you understand, on the girls' track team. This was learned on Monday this week by Township High School District 211 in Palatine, Illinois. This school was aware of the problem, but they tried to finesse it by putting up privacy curtains in the girls' showers. "That was okay," said the feds, "but you can't make any student use the privacy curtains. If Louis wants to shower with Louise, you have to let him." You still don't see the blessings of a thermonuclear bomb over Washington, D.C.? Item. I watched the World Series, as I always do, and here's my question. What's with the beards? When did 20 and 30-something guys all start sporting face fungus? These things come and go, of course. If memory serves, there was a gent in 19th century Massachusetts who was refused entry to his church one Sunday because he was clean-shaven. Perhaps we're headed back to the full Karl Marx, Charles Darwin look. Who knows? Well, it'll be one less thing to change when the country makes the switch to Sharia law. Item. Finally, some news from Turkmenistan. Could we have some of the national anthem, please? Yes, Radio Derb's dear old friend and business associate, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of the noble Republic of Turkmenistan, graciously received our Secretary of State, John Kerry, on Tuesday this week. I'm sorry to report that our Secretary of State did not respond with equal grace. Instead, he made a show of chiding President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov for so-called human rights abuses. As if the whole world does not know that these are vile slanders put about by exile wreckers and saboteurs. Turkmenistan state media, including our own affiliate, reported in a fair and balanced way on Kerry's visit, according him all the respect due to a gullible lackey of the exile cliques. And may I take this opportunity to deny once again that our parent organisation, Derb International, has been shown any favouritism whatsoever in the allocation of oil and natural gas drilling rights in Turkmenistan. Again, these are lies put about by enemies of the great, the beloved President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. Now I am off to the historic city of Baltimore to attend the annual meeting of the H.L. Mencken Club. Saturday evening, after we're through with the lectures and presentations, I aim to go off alone and roam the streets of this famous city, looking at all the fine buildings in their nighttime splendour. I understand it's quite expensive down there, so I'll be carrying plenty of cash with me. I did want to find some Baltimore-themed music to see us out, but nothing came to mind. The best I can do is this very moving rendition of the Maryland State Song by Tennessee Ernie Ford. It's a lovely song with fine, stirring lyrics. The despot's heel is on thy shore, Maryland, my Maryland. His torch is at thy temple door, Maryland, my Maryland. Lovely. I have no idea who the despot was, but I hope the fine people of Maryland taught him a sharp lesson. More from Radio Derb next week.
But heel is on thy shore, Maryland, my Maryland. His torch is at thy temple door, Maryland, my Maryland. Avenge the patriotic gore that flecked the streets of Baltimore, and be the battle.